This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, Harlem natives blame former President Clinton for unaffordable housing, and Hollywood's hottest investment, Tyler Perry, joining us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Mary Frances Berry. She's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. From Spotland Productions in Nashville, Tennessee, Jeff Obafemi-Carr. Jeff is host of the radio program Freestyle. And from our Chicago bureau, Roland Martin, executive editor of the Chicago Defender. I thank you all for joining us. Greatly appreciated. We want to get right into this question of what many people are joking about. There goes the neighborhood. We just talked about the shrinking middle class. And Mary, your friend, President Clinton, is being blamed by some residents in Harlem for making that area now unaffordable, that they are seeing skyrocketing property prices and the like since he's moved in. The reality is, while that may be the case to some degree, we are seeing areas like Harlem being gentrified, as people like to say, taken over, and those who've been long-term residents are now finding it almost impossible to live in these areas.
Well, I guess it is true that no good deed goes unpunished, because the big guy, President Clinton, moved into the neighborhood because he thought that that would show his appreciation and help to revitalize the neighborhood, and he loves to be around black people. Mm-hmm. So for all of those reasons, and good restaurants where you can eat soul food or whatever, and for all of those reasons, he moved into the neighborhood, and it was great, and everybody was excited. I remember when he first did it. But people weren't thinking about what was going to happen to the prices. And so I think that it probably is a two-edged sword. Some people are benefiting from the rise in prices, but a lot are being moved aside, like they are in other neighborhoods in cities all around this country where gentrification is going on. And so I guess Bill Clinton was wise to do what he did when he was asked, was to have no comment.
Ed, I want to correct something. First of all, Bill Clinton did not choose to move into Harlem as the first option. Remember, the Manhattan office space that he wanted was far too expensive. Congress, the Republican-led Congress, objected, and then Harlem was a second option. So I think that is a critical point. I think the problem with this issue that African Americans are going to have to deal with, and that is, we cannot on one hand demand development, demand stores, restaurants, say, well, we want the same amenities that you receive in other communities, but then when the prices go up, then say, well, they shouldn't go up. I mean, this is America. It is still capitalism. There is a reason when prices are depressed, when they are down, because there are things that are not there. People who own businesses, they tend to build in places based upon homeowners, not necessarily renters. And so when you look at master plan communities all across the country, that is one of the issues. It is not necessarily just a black issue. In Houston, Texas, in a neighborhood called the Heights, it's a very old neighborhood. It was largely white, in terms of majority white. And they began to really complain because you had urban professionals, namely white, who were moving back into the city. They began to erect homes that were $400,000 to $600,000. That caused the property taxes to then go up. And then people said, I can't even afford to pay my property taxes. It is a dilemma, because we're saying we want cities, we want a resurgence in cities, but then at the same time, we don't want prices to go up. And so you got to achieve some kind of balance. As to how to achieve that, I really don't know, because, again, this is capitalism. This is what it does. And so it can't have it both ways.
Jeff, I want to make sure that people understand the dynamic of the increase in pricing. According to the Washington Post, the top price for a brownstone terrace in Harlem in 2001 was about $400,000. Now that house, fully renovated, we should note, cost as much as $4 million.
Oh, indeed. And you're talking $2 to $3 million to buy it as a rotted out shell. When I was living in New York and East Harlem, there were places that you could get in Harlem for $250,000. And that was 1998, 1999. So we
and
see
why
this,
was that, Jeff?
Well, it was because, to be honest, there weren't many white people coming up into Harlem, and there weren't businesses there. That was before the old Navy store got there.
It was before the
gentrification. It was before all of that.
But you
now,
know what, Jeff? You know what, Jeff, yeah, and Roland? I think that since Clinton moved to Harlem and these prices have gone up as a second option, what he should now do is move to the Bronx. And he should go around moving to different neighborhoods so that they can become gentrified in his wake. I may suggest that to him.
If in fact it is tied to
one
Clinton,
man economic development team.
We know that Clinton, though, we know that this is happening all over the place in every urban area, whether it's 12th South in South Nashville, West End in Atlanta and Ashby Street area, or Harlem in New York. Gentrification is the order of the day, and with the growing relocation of all of these inner city entertainment venues, downtown revitalization efforts in major cities, rising gas prices, property inside the city loop is going blindingly fast, and Clinton may have been a visionary. One could argue that he knew what was coming and was just in the first wave.
Roland, what is the idea that people argue that there should be some kind of preservation for areas like Harlem for African Americans or other minorities who have a particular historical investment to a particular area?
Well, if you establish that, then you can say the exact same thing for Italian enclaves and white and Polish and others. And so how do you make that standard? Basically, what that also says is that we want a protected black place here in America where you can have prices that are low. The issue here is not necessarily just a matter of prices going up, because, again, you can't on one hand ask for development, and you can't ask then for low crime. You can't ask for all those things that come with that, but then you say don't want prices to go up. I think an issue is also wages. Are people able to live there based upon what they make and what they earn? And that's part of the problem, not just in Harlem, but also across the country. Secondly, the development took place before Clinton was got there as well.
Well, there is something people can do, Roland, and you guys. There is something they can do. Cities can demand mixed income housing in areas and develop it so that there is a mix of range of income that are able to buy houses and reserve that. There are development plans that can do that.
Yeah, but Mary, we just heard in segment A that we are moving to a country that is haves and have-nots, and one would believe that the rich folk won't want to have mixed enclaves and would fight feverishly to keep it that way.
Well, the rich folks may fight to do that, but there are more poor folk who can vote if they will than rich folk, and if they will, they can get cities to come up with development plans. And there are some areas and some cities where there are plans and there are mixed income developments. Yes.
We've done it in Tennessee too, but there's always a catch here when we talk about this. There are organizations, large developers, that build a relationship with local government where they have a certain number of units. Say, for instance, they build a row of brownstones or they build a condominium tower. They reserve a certain number of those for average income, the average income to middle income people. But if you're building a 50 unit tower, most of the time when we talk about a relationship with government, if you save 3 to 5 of those units out of 50 units for somebody that's of average income, you still achieve the same effect of locking most people out of their economic opportunity in a new neighborhood.
All right, let's move on to another quandary, if you will, and that's what many schools are finding themselves in. And that is, as the United States grows and browns, as we like to call it in the media, we're finding that schools are having to determine whether or not they're going to acknowledge and give days off for more than just Christian and Jewish holidays. It's interesting, Jeff, because this is something that I've often thought about, and now we're seeing it come to fruition, the idea that Muslims or Buddhists, Hindus, and others want their holidays recognized, yet you've got to send kids to school.
Oh, you have to send kids to school, and you have to, in a pluralistic society, respect people. Now, where do you draw that line of respect? Where do you say one person's religion is more legitimate? Where do the Christians, Muslims fall in when you take them and juxtapose their religious beliefs and their holy days, so to speak, the origin of the word holidays, and you juxtapose that with the Hindu or the Buddhist or the people who practice Ifa or Santeria or any number of other religions that are out here that claim as much legitimacy in the way they raise their kids and teach them their spiritual point of perspective? I think that personally, I think giving people a certain number of days as days that would be excused absences and allowing people to work that out amongst themselves would be the best option for this, as opposed to trying to litter the calendar with holidays one way or the other.
agree.
We're finding
that
in some regions, Mary, pick up on your point. We're finding that in some regions, but we're also finding some areas where there is a louder cry for the extended holiday to be recognized, for the entire school to have to take off.
No, I think the best solution to it is to let everyone pick their own set of religious holidays and voluntarily or work it out practically with the school system. For example, we may have to recognize that the Muslim religion is the fastest growing religion in the United States, and there are more and more children who are in school systems. And so it doesn't make any sense to privilege one. I happen to be a Christian, but that doesn't mean that I should be privileged over my children, should be privileged over other people's kids. And so therefore, I think that the best way to handle it, and as somebody who teaches practically, figure out which holidays people have to take off for religious observance, work around it, and let everyone choose. That's about the only thing you can do. Otherwise, you just have to not let anybody be off for any holiday, which I think is unacceptable.
Well, Roland, obviously, when these days off started, the vast majority of people going to these schools were Christians. Then we saw the Jewish holidays being given calendar days off for schools. Yet we are starting to hear, even in communities where there may be a disproportionate amount of another religion versus the Jewish religion, clamors and concerns and complaints about the idea that if a Jewish religion is given a calendar day off in school, then these other religions should be.
Well, I think the people who want to criticize one religion but then protect theirs should frankly shut up, even especially those who are Christians, because I find that to be completely ignorant. You can't say, well, what's good for me is not good for you. If you're going to designate religious holidays, this is what is going to happen. You're going to open Pandora's box. You're going to have to deal with other religions. And so it can't be, well, what's the threshold? Does it have to be 20%? No. Once you begin to go down that line, this is what you're going to have to face. I mean, as Jeff stated, if it is on an individual basis, that is a different story than saying we're going to give the entire school off because of that. I mean, you know, I remember there were Jewish students in my high school, very few of them, who were off certain days because of their holidays. But it was a 90% black high school. Well, what do you do there? Again, I think an individual basis makes a lot of sense, as opposed to, because once you start talking about four or five different religions and the whole school being off, I mean, you're right. When the heck are they learning?
All right. Let's turn our attention very quickly to something we found interesting, and this is from businessweek.com. They gave out awards for Hollywood's biggest earners. And the award essentially talked about the person who enjoys the highest return on investment for their movies, paying back the Hollywood studios that usually pay the freight up front. Not Tom Cruise, not Tom Hanks, not Johnny Depp, but Tyler Perry was first and foremost among those in Hollywood. Interesting here, Jeff, because Hollywood is such a trend city that one would believe the trend of Tyler Perry making huge dollars would bring a spate of black movies to the big screen, but we're not seeing that necessarily.
Yeah, we're not seeing that, and I think that that's very important to point out, that Hollywood still has, by and large, African Americans in a certain kind of hole. Now, when we say Denzel is a bankable star, he definitely is in the mainstream and in our community too. But we look at the phenomenon of Tyler Perry. Tyler tapped into a vein, particularly an African American urban vein that was kind of in the same tradition as Shelley Garrett, Michael Matthews, and several of the other people who produced some of the gospel plays. Tyler found a groove that allowed him to create a mass audience, and you have to respect that on one level. I think that if we say we're going to have Hollywood power, though, we have to get out of what Donald Bogle would call our traditional images. I mean, could Tyler have done it without putting on a dress? Could Tyler have done it without a lot of slapstick comedy, even though there are good messages embedded in that? Will we see movies now that will be able to project us image-wise in a positive way, where we're not joking on each other, where we're not smoking weed and wearing dresses if we're men? Can we break out of that mode? That's what I'm more concerned about.
Roland, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the movie coming up starring Jamie Foxx, Beyonce, and Eddie Murphy, Dreamgirls, finally coming to the big screen.
Well, again, that's even different. First of all, this is a business article. It was in Business Week. The difference is, as Jeff touched on, that is, Tyler brought his audience with him. These other folks, they don't bring an audience with them. They have not cultivated an audience. And so with E-Blast, with his database, with people who are familiar with his name and his productions and the creation of the character, that's why he is so bankable. It's the opposite with the rest of these folks. That you're tied to one individual based upon a celebrity or a personality, and then you hope people will show up because it's Denzel. But remember, Denzel has had bombs. Beyonce has had bombs. And so this is a different kind of thing. Plus, his costs are lower because he writes it, he directs it, he produces it. He also largely markets it. And so that's the difference. What I hope you'll see is that African Americans will begin to who take those audiences, begin to cultivate that niche among black media, black websites, black newspapers, black radio. And then once they begin to go to the mainstream, you, in essence, your foundation is built and they come along with you.
And I think the answer to Jeff's question about whether we will now see different kinds of movies, is the answer is no. That worked. The script worked. And in addition to everything Roland said, it was the script. It was a kind of movie that had this kind of audience. And there is a great audience for that. The man, anywhere, dress, tell, crack the jokes, do the whatever, all of that. And so I think we'll probably see more movies like that, which is what Hollywood does. If one kind of script works, one kind of product works, they'll just keep trying it.
Yeah, right, indeed. Right. And it does. And the message, somebody once, I read a critique of Soul Food. They said, well, Soul Food was a different kind of movie. And I said, well, if you look at Soul Food, the message in Soul Food is you get together and you gorge yourself with all of this food that is unhealthy. And then the grandmama's dying because she ate that kind of food. But you glorify it. So, I mean, in the end, well, I want to see a little bit of a different kind of film. I hope we'll see that emerge.
All right. Interesting way to look at it. All right, Mary, Jeff, and Roland, thanks so much. Greatly appreciate it.
Going to eat some ham now, Ed. Thanks so much.
I already ate it, man. Thank you. Next up on News and Notes, thinking outside the box when learning a new language and bringing a bit of comic relief to communities in crisis. Clowns Without Borders lifts the spirits of refugees in war-torn regions.